Now, this is obviously under normal circumstances. We do have the odd exception now and then. We don't want to get into the exceptions, though. But for example, a person, you know, is doing something, and out of the goodness of your heart, you encourage that person. You say, "What you are doing is good. Continue the good work." You know, if possible, you tell that person, "If you need a hand, let me help you." But you don't want to step on his toes. You don't want to take that particular thing away from him. You're like, no, he's doing something good. I want to help him, or I will encourage him. You think good of that person. Another place, you know, a person comes to you for a help, and you say, like, no, this person truly needs help. And if you have the ability, you do it. If you don't, you don't. Someday that person just comes and asks how you are. They say salams to you. They want to greet you. And you return the greeting and you say, this person is only trying to be friendly. He's only trying to, you know, do some of his Islamic responsibilities in greeting. Not that he wants something from me, or he wants to, you know, get closer to me and so on and so forth. No, nothing like that. You just think good of people. By doing that, people will understand and see that, no, this person is a good person. They will naturally become attracted to you. Especially good people will get attracted to you. Because they see this person is good, and good attracts good. We ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to enable us of those who attain and garner the love of people because of our actions, and not because of anything else. The sincerity of our actions, more importantly. Inshallah, until next time, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
That was the program Hadith of the Day on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Yasser Ibrahim, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
Here I am, pleading at your door. Send me your mercy, send me your peace, or I am lost for sure. Oh Lord, here I am, yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more, no more.
This spotlight. Bring us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. A New York Times report reveals how the U.S. military bombs civilians in Syria and then bulldozes the site to try to cover up the news. A 500-pound bomb was dropped on mostly women and children. Then it was followed by two more bombs, taking care of any survivors. At the end, at least 80 people were killed. The U.S. says 16 of them were fighters and four were civilians, and they did not bother to even try to describe who the others were. However, they had decided to sit on the news of this act to try to avoid being accused of committing a war crime. Stay with us as we take a look at this event on this Spotlight.
It's March 18th, 2019. An American F-15 drops a 500-pound bomb on a crowd of women and children in an area near the town of Baghouz in Syria's Deir ez-Zor province. Minutes later, another warplane drops an even bigger bomb, then another, killing the few survivors of the first strike. The initial death toll was put at 70. Fast forward to November 2021. The U.S. Central Command has acknowledged that 80 people were killed in the strikes. While claiming that 16 of the victims were Daesh terrorists, it admits that it's unclear if the rest were civilians. CENTCOM has also defended the attacks as justified and conducted in self-defense, arguing that the targeted women and children could have been combatants. But investigations carried out by the New York Times provide a different account of the incident. According to the Times, a U.S. Air Force lawyer who oversaw the operation believed he had witnessed possible war crimes and notified the authorities. The Pentagon later carried out an independent inquiry into the incident, but the Times says the subsequent report was, quote, stripped of any mention of the bombing. The newspaper also says the reports were delayed and classified and the attack site was bulldozed shortly after.
So this is one piece that is coming out very important because it shows just how criminal the war is and the cover-up that takes place at every level, even when within the army, those who saw it and have access tried to bring it to light and instead were dismissed.
The report bore a striking resemblance to a U.S. drone strike in the Afghan capital Kabul in late August this year that claimed the lives of 10 members of the same family, including 7 children. The U.S. military initially said it had targeted a Daesh terrorist planning a suicide attack in the wake of the bombing at the Kabul airport that had killed 13 U.S. troops and dozens of Afghan civilians 3 days before. The Pentagon similarly defended the botched strike as a, quote, righteous one.
Daniel Hale, the former U.S. Air Force intelligence analyst who worked with the NSA, who worked with JSOC, is now going to be spending the next 45 months in prison for having let the world know that 90% of the victims of U.S. airstrikes are innocent bystanders, basically civilians.
To put things into perspective, the United States conducted about 1,000 airstrikes in Syria and Iraq in 2019 alone, using over 4,700 bombs and missiles. The official civilian toll for the entire year is 22.
I'd like to welcome my guests to this spotlight. William Jones, from Executive Intelligence Review out of Leesburg, Virginia. And Danny Shaw, author and international affairs analyst out of New York.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Well, thank you both for being with us on this spotlight. Let's start this off with William. I mean, why has it taken almost 3 years for this news to be exposed? I mean, there had been people in the area who were eyewitnesses, as well as the central command in Qatar, that watched a whole event via drone footage. So why did it take so long?
Well, this was obviously a major cover-up. We don't know how often this happens. I mean, the fact that there was a whistleblower here and this has been revealed probably indicates that there are maybe dozens more of such incidents that are never reported. It was a tremendous operation, so many people who were killed in this, a tremendous mistake on many, many levels. And then it was increased by a conscious attempt to bury it. And this is which is the bigger crime. The death of the individuals, of course, is the most horrendous. But the fact that this can occur without oversight condemns the entire war operations that the United States is conducting in this region. And it also points out the fact that the United States war in Syria is a serious breach, a serious crime of itself, because if they had been working with the Syrian government, which they're fighting against, they could have revealed already what the problem was, what was the situation on the ground, and this would have never occurred. But the fact that the United States has placed itself in opposition to the legitimate government of Syria is really the basic problem that we're dealing with here, leading to this tragedy.
Danny, why do you think the New York Times has actually revealed this news? I mean, as William said, there are so many incidents that probably take place and go about with little or no reporting, especially in the corporate media. Your assessment of that?
Well, as if we needed more proof that to the U.S. military-industrial complex, Syrian lives do not matter, Kurdish lives do not matter, Palestinian, Iranian, Iraqi, Afghan lives do not matter. Why is it taking 3 years for this to come to light? How many other similar incidents with all of the drones and bombs the U.S. is piloting from Somalia to Yemen to the invisible bombs that they drop every day on the Venezuelan people, on the Cuban people, now rejuvenated sanctions against the Nicaraguan people. The U.S. has no right to be in Syria in the first place. So hopefully this sparks these important conversations about Syrian self-determination. No one has endured more suffering than the Syrian people in their struggle against Daesh. And as has become very clear, Daesh has powerful, powerful international backers. This has never been a civil war in Syria. It's been an internationalized conflict with the Saudis and the Turks, and of course, the largest imperialist overlord, the U.S., backing any anti-Assad, any anti-Syrian Arab army forces that they can.
Well, William, the U.S. military authorities say that 16 of those killed out of 80 were fighters. And even if they are correct, how can they justify killing so many women and children? And if they didn't know when they dropped the first bomb that there were civilians there, why did they drop a second and a third?
Well, this is a very good question. I mean, the New York Times has a lot of details on this, the fact that the people who were calling in these bombs were a very, very secret operation. And many of the monitors that existed, including one of the cameras, one of the high-resolution cameras that were looking at it, was not available to them. And but they had the authority to call in this tremendous operation, allegedly only to be done if they were under fire, which, of course, was not the case here. So there was a tremendous breach of even the rules of war, as is understood by the American military, and it may very well amount to war crimes. That a court, I think, will have to decide on that. But it's just really gotten out of control. The whole war situation has gotten out of control. And if the U.S. continues in this direction, you're going to have many more things like this. But I think that now that whatever the reasons were for the New York Times to reveal this thing, it was surprising for me that they did it and not somebody else, I think will lead to a major investigation, not only of this specific incident and not only of the rules of war as we know it today, but also will call into question the very commitment that the U.S. has made to fight against the legitimate regime of Assad in Syria. And perhaps there will be a reaction against this whole kettle of fish that has been built up by the military outreach and extended operations of the United States worldwide.
Well, William, just staying with you, because you just talked about not sure why the New York Times revealed it as they had, because that was my previous question, why did they do it? But now that they have, do you think perhaps that we are entering a type of transition, perhaps some type of reckoning, that actually the mainstream media is willing to critically look at what has taken place and what is continuing to take place in Syria?
I wouldn't go so far as to say that, knowing the mainstream media. In this instance, I probably suspect that the people who were involved in exposing this, who actually presented the information also to a congressional committee, and we're not getting a whole lot of response from them, also felt that by going public, they would get that response. Things would start to move. And of course, they went to the New York Times, and I don't think the New York Times is going to let a story like this go when they can make some hay out of it and make also profit out of that. But I don't think there's been a main change in the mainstream media. They go along to get along, and the change has got to come elsewhere. It's got to come from the American people. And it's got to come from the American people putting pressure on their congressmen to stop this war. We know the situation generally President Biden got out of Afghanistan, because there's a general mood not to be in the war fighting business here in the United States. And that mood has got to make itself felt among the legislators if we're ever going to avoid problems like we see in this incident.
Okay.
So I don't think there'll be a change there, but I think there is a tremendous change in the public mood against this type of war fighting, policeman-like operations that the U.S. has been conducting over the whole world.
Well, Danny, there was an investigation, an incident, but it was internal. Now, if U.S. forces thought that their attacks were actually justified, why did they bulldoze the area then to try to hide the evidence?
Yeah, it's like the NYPD or any police department investigating themselves. We could never trust that investigation. It should be the Syrian authorities, the just authorities of the region who investigate. Certainly when the entire area was bulldozed, that is very telling. It does come as a type of shock that it was the New York Times, one of the main mouthpieces of the military-industrial complex. The New York Times, together with the Washington Post and CNN, the whole gamut of liberal, neoliberal media, has always beat the drums of war, bombs away on Yugoslavia, bombs away on Panama, bombs away on Libya, nothing but unfettered aggression against Syrian self-determination. But within these mainstream corporate media complex, you are going to have certain critical voices. Perhaps this was going to be leaked somewhere else. So, as William said, the Times got ahead of it so they could cash in on what is more Syrian suffering.
William, one of the Air Force's lawyers, Lieutenant Colonel Dean Corsack, believed that he had witnessed a war crime and tried to tell higher authorities, but nothing happened except that he was sidelined. And, I mean, we have seen whistleblowers, especially in dealing with the military-industrial complex, paying a major, major price. But the actual problem is really never addressed. Your take on this?
Well, it seems to me that there's an issue here of why this attack was called for in the first place. And according to the rules of war, it could be done only if the people calling it were in danger, and that doesn't seem to be the case now. But you've had them bending the rules a lot in this respect. And by bending the rules, they probably got to a point where they actually broke the rules. And we'll have to figure out if there was culpability on the part of the people involved in this thing, and that
well,
it was
well, let me
a
just
crime.
Jump in here. You say bending the rules, William, but even according to what you said earlier, which of course is true, I mean, the U.S. being there is actually illegal, right? Because the sovereign government never invited them in. So do you think that basically rules here are as the Americans create them as they go? Because if we start from the first point of it, it's illegal for them to even be there.
That's correct. That is the fundamental the fundamental crime here is the war in Syria, in which we are actually supporting groups that would ordinarily be called terrorists because they're in opposition to President Assad, and we are also opposed to the Assad regime. That is the primary problem, that it's a legitimate government that was elected by the people. They're conducting the operations of the country, and we're trying to conduct a revolution against them in the operations in Syria. That's the primary crime, but there are also two other issues here. Was there a crime, even according to the rules of war for the United States, conducted in this particular incident? And more specifically, there must have been a crime. There was probably even a greater crime in covering it up, because the cover-up itself can be an illegal matter, which will lead to jail time. Obviously, somebody will get fired, but could even be jail time for people who perpetrated the cover-up. And I think that's what we're going to see moving forward. And I think this is going to be very much in the public view. And I think that will be very useful to teach the American public about what's actually going on.
But at the end of the day, William, sorry to jump in. At the end of the day, if anyone pays, what we have seen in the past is usually that it's some low-level military personnel that actually ends up paying the price. Never the higher-ups, the general or whomever gave the actual order. I mean, we have seen that time and time again, that those who are mostly responsible for these crimes never pay a price.
That's absolutely right. And I think the problem is that the American citizenry have got to become much more enraged about this thing in order to force a change of policy and to hold those responsible who have been responsible for war crimes. And it's not simply the soldiers on the ground who are carrying out orders. It's the people who are giving the orders in a war that is unjustified, that is illegal, and that is itself a crime against humanity.
Well, Danny, in general, why aren't these cases like this taken more seriously? Because if they're not investigated, excuse me, and the right people actually punished, then it's going to be repeated time and time again. Are lives in this region of the world less important for the American military?
That's 100% correct. I mean, what is legality to the U.S. unipolar hegemon? They could care less about international law. They trample over this paper law and mock it all day, every day, across the world, in every continent, in every ocean. How many hundreds and hundreds, 800 plus U.S. military bases stationed around the world to patrol and surveil and invade and occupy the sovereignty of any country on earth? As William has said, the underlying sin, the original crime, is the invasion, the occupation. Why is there one U.S. troop in Syrian territory? It's such an incredible double standard. They would never allow one Cuban soldier or one Syrian soldier within the U.S.'s territorial boundaries. And what we've continually seen, when there are brave whistleblowers, they go after these whistleblowers, Chelsea Manning, Edward Snowden, Julian Assange, with everything to send a clear message to the everyday Americans and GIs in the military, don't you dare raise your voice, or we'll put you in a box, we'll lock you up, we'll put you away forever, striking fear into how many young people who actually want to do the right thing. So when has the military brass, when have the West Point graduates, the generals, ever done a day in jail, been court-martialed? And the true war criminals, from Obama to Bush to Trump to whoever's in the Oval Office right now, it's bipartisan. These are war criminals on both sides of the aisle, and they need to be held responsible. But it'll never be the New York Times. It'll never be this system that holds the war criminals responsible. It has to be a mass movement in the streets. And hopefully this can be a teachable moment so that more young people join this anti-imperialist movement.
Well, William, again, if these crimes are not paid for, the situation would obviously just be repeated. I mean, we saw in Afghanistan just a few months ago when Americans bombed a house and killed 10 civilians, including 7 kids. At first, Washington reported it was an attack on Daesh, and then it was forced to admit that it had killed civilians. And so far, nothing has been done. No compensation, nothing, although the U.S. gave some verbal commitments. And, of course, these people's lives cannot be returned either way. So shouldn't there be more severe punishment? And if it's not going to come from within, what needs to be done? What kind of system needs to be set up to hold them responsible?
Well, you know, the United States and President Biden is always harping on the so-called rule of law when he's talking about Russia, he's talking about China. Obviously, there should be a rule of law which is beneficial for the population. And now that it's on the table, I think other countries as well will be talking about how must the world operate? How must countries work together in order to create better situations for their citizenry? I think that you'll see on the international scale an attempt to maybe not legislate, but at least to create a framework of legislation for how countries have to act how they have to act if they have to go to war, and how they can stop going to war. But I think also in the country, as your other speaker said, there is a reaction from the American people, and it's a very divided country at the moment, and I think people will be out on the streets demanding change at the highest levels of this type of policy making, which they've just become tired of.
Well, Danny, just 1 minute we have left. Do you think the only guarantee for the safety of the people in this region is that the U.S. must leave Western Asia?
No question. U.S. out of the Middle East, the U.S. out of Asia, the U.S. out of the Caribbean, the U.S. out of every territory that they've invaded. How many coups post-World War II? How many coups, how many illegal invasions and occupations and drone bombings in the last century plus? But every dog has his day. None of these generals, none of these statesmen are invincible. The sun set on the British Empire and the Tsarist Empire. It will soon set on U.S. imperialism, the most powerful, arrogant empire in human history, so that at last the world's people can breathe in peace and get this imperial knife out of their neck.
And with that note, I appreciate both of you being with me. William Jones, Executive Intelligence Review out of Leesburg, Virginia, and Danny Shaw, author and international affairs analyst out of New York. And we appreciate you being with us on the Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashemi.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu Alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran, by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Hello everyone, dear brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, and we're with you with another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. In this edition of the program, we'll be discussing the commentary of the 23rd chapter of the Holy Quran, Surah Al-Mu'minun, or the Believers. Now let's just listen to the related verses, and then we'll be back. So stay with us.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
Alam takun ayati tutla alaykum fakun.
It will be said, were not my verses recited to you and you used to deny them?
Brothers and sisters, in the previous program, we were talking about the 104th and 5th verses of the chapter. تَلْفَحُ وُجُوهَهُمُ النَّارِ وَهُمْ فِيهَا كَالِحُونَ. ألم تكن آياتي تتلى عليكم فكنتم بها تكذبون. And they are told, were not my signs recited to you and then you used to belie them? So these couple of verses were talking about the punishments, both spiritual and physical punishments of the disbelievers. Now, this verse, أَلَمْ تَكُنْ آيَاتِ تُتْلَى عَلَيْكُمْ, were not my signs recited to you, is implying that even though Allah sent them enough signs and reasons through His prophets, even though the Almighty Allah gave them a strong argument, they continued their denial, they continued their rejection. Now, let's have a look at another word of this verse. The word, the Arabic verb tutla, is translated as recited, and the word tukadhibun is translated as you used to belie. They are both in the future tense in the Arabic text, and it makes this fact clear that the divine verses were recited to them continually, and they also continually used to deny them. So, as I just mentioned, the Almighty Allah first sends the people enough argument, and only then, if the people are not guided, we have the right to see them as punished. Although most of the time, they are under the shadow of the Almighty Allah's mercy. In this regard, the Holy Prophet ﷺ has said, two kinds of eyes are saved from the fire of hell. One eye that weeps inside the night out of fear of Allah, and another that does not sleep in the way of Allah. And this is what awaits the true servant of the Almighty Allah. Although he might have some mistakes, he might have some wrong deeds, he is always fearful of his Lord. The Prophet ﷺ has said elsewhere, one who sheds tears out of fear of Allah will not be burnt by the fire, as milked milk does not return to the udder. And this is so interesting, how the Holy Prophet is putting this concept in the words. It means it is truly impossible that the eyes which shed tears out of fear of Allah will not be burnt.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
In this
word.
Series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic
approach. We will inshallah discuss the chapter
وتمثل القرآن في أخلاقه وفعاله فيه الفؤاد تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran. By Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. And this concept of fear of the Almighty Allah is one of the most important elements of the true personalities of the believers. The Holy Prophet ﷺ has said, he who is the best among mankind in the sight of the Almighty Allah is the one who fears Almighty Allah the most. If you fear Allah
as he deserves to be feared of, you will obtain a kind of knowledge where everything will become clear to you, and you will no longer be ignorant. And if you know Allah as he deserves to be known, you can move mountains by your prayers. So the Almighty Allah will accept the supplications of these kinds of servants. Imam Sadiq alayhi salam has said, it is suitable for the believer to fear Allah to such an extent that it would be as if he were about to fall into hell, and trust Allah to such an extent as if he were one of the people of paradise. That's it, dear listeners, regarding these two verses. And that's why when these unbelievers, they have the right to be punished. In the next verse, the Almighty Allah's conversation with these unbelievers is mentioned. And the Almighty Allah is addressing them scornfully. And the Almighty Allah is inquiring them, asking, أَلَمْ تَكُنْ آيَاتِ تُتْلَى عَلَيْكُمْ, were not my signs recited to you, فَكُنْتُمْ بِهَا تُكَذِّبُونَ, and you used to belie them. Thank you, dear listeners, for staying with us in this program. We ask the Almighty Allah to set us among the guided ones and the people of the straight path. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parsetoday.com. Until the next program, take care.
Things always worked for me. Worry ends when faith begins.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Of Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Russia, Zaglam, Istanbul.
Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
10 innocent family members were killed by a U.S. drone strike on a home in Kabul. After the attack, the Pentagon apologized for the mistake and said the U.S. is considering making payments to the family of the victims and will get them out of Afghanistan. But it seems Washington has been indifferent to these promises as the family still awaits justice.
The attack was very horrific to our family. It martyred 10 of our loved ones and shocked those who have survived. When our relatives come here, it hurts them as they remember those innocent children martyred here. Of course, the U.S. should be held accountable.
Justice should be done to us. They promised that those responsible would be tried in a court, compensation would be paid, and they would take us out of Afghanistan. After their announcement, they have done nothing. They must stay true to their commitments.
Afghans and U.S. war survivors have repeatedly asked for meaningful transparency and accountability for the U.S. killings of their loved ones, but they have not received it from Washington so far.
The U.S. has always lied to these people. They make promises but don't fulfill them. For instance, see Ajmal's family that were decimated by the U.S. All of those killed were innocent. It has been 3 months that their relatives are left helpless.
People also believe that during its invasion of Afghanistan, the U.S. military has always killed civilians, lied about it, and finally exonerated themselves. More than 2 months after this tragic attack, the U.S. has not taken any practical steps to reach out to the victims' family or pay compensation to them. And the survivors are still awaiting justice. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Pervasive challenges remain for migrants and asylum seekers no matter Europe, the United States, or Asia. The recent immigrant crisis on the Belarusian border with Poland has refreshed the plight refugees have endured at the hands of some governments. Thousands of asylum seekers are currently stranded in desperate conditions on the Belarusian border, with thousands of Polish soldiers, guards, and police on the other side blocking their entry. Ironically, the European Union has backed Poland's move in line with the bloc's resolve that it will go to any length to prevent migrants from reaching its external borders. This means turning a blind eye to even gross human rights abuses against refugees. Instead of searching for a mechanism to resolve the crisis, the EU has rather opened a diplomatic war with Belarus and Russia by directly pointing its finger at the two for the current problem. The 27-member bloc is not an exception. Just recently, the United States violently encountered with mostly Haitian immigrants near its borders. Hundreds were deported and thousands were sent to detention centers. It seems the Biden administration has continued the footsteps of its predecessor that took a tough stance on asylum seekers. An estimated 70,000 people destined for the U.S. have encountered with similar fates over the past 4 years. The brutal family separation was the darkest part of the Trump era, as authorities are still unable to track down parents of hundreds of kids. The treatment of immigrants by the U.S. highlights its double standards on human rights. The issue Washington often uses as a pretext to impose sanctions on others. But the real question is, what is the root cause of the migrant crisis? Isn't the West, especially the United States, the main culprit for its wars and the subsequent influx of refugees in countries such as Syria, Iraq, Libya, Yemen, and Afghanistan? Afghanistan is a live example that was left in a mess by the U.S. and its allies after almost 2 decades of military presence. People had no choice but to flee the country after the Taliban takeover in mid-August. The number of immigrants has even increased in neighboring Iran, with over 5,000 Afghans reportedly entering the country on a daily basis. The UN has praised Iran, but the sanctions-hit country hasn't received some $136 million in funding the world body said the Islamic Republic needed to support the refugees.
Tens of thousands of workers belonging to South Korea's largest umbrella labor union rallied on the streets of downtown Seoul, defying a city government ban on their gathering.
The current infringement of basic rights by the government under the name of coronavirus prevention is a blindly criminal act which destroys the Constitution.
At the rally location in 1970, 22-year-old Chun Tae-il burned himself to death to protest against the terrible working conditions he endured. The COVID-19 pandemic has hit those in the service sector particularly hard, with layoffs and reductions in hours.
This year especially, many casual workers have suffered because of the coronavirus. They've lost their jobs and had their income reduced due to unpaid leave. We are holding this rally to stop this irrationality.
Demonstrators also protested the gap between regular and irregular workers and a growing disparity between haves and have-nots. South Korean truckers and railway workers have been threatening walkouts recently, with Hyundai union workers voting to strike Friday. South Koreans will be heading to the polls in about 5 months to elect a new president of the country. The main candidates have been decided, and now political forces, like the unionists here today, have begun to battle to see their interests top the campaign agenda. Frank Smith, Seoul.
In a fresh air strike carried out by Saudi warplanes against Yemenis, 4 civilians, including 3 children, were killed. 2 others were also wounded in the strike in Tuhaita district in the Hodeidah province. Officials say the attack is a clear violation of the Stockholm Agreement that prohibited airstrikes on the coastal province.
There are many violations committed by the Saudi-led coalition, whether through airstrikes or direct attacks on civilians by the mercenaries in Tuhaita and other areas. The Stockholm Agreement prohibited any military action in the Hodeidah Governorate, but unfortunately, the violations of this unbrokered agreement did not stop.
Observers say the international community's inaction towards the continuous Saudi attacks on Yemeni civilians, especially the silence of the UN Security Council, is yet another proof of how Riyadh is bribing its way through the world body.
Through our long experience with the United Nations, it's clear that Saudi and Emirati money plays the most prominent role in determining the decisions of the world body, including the Security Council, the Secretary General, and the UN envoy. There is a clear bias regarding the Saudi-led coalition.
Earlier, Yemen's armed forces took control of several districts in the coastal province of Hodeidah, including the international road linking Sana'a with Hodeidah, after a sudden withdrawal of the Emirati-backed forces.
Regardless of the catastrophic situation in Yemen, which the UN describes as the world's worst humanitarian crisis, the international community keeps turning a blind eye to the Saudi violations against millions of Yemenis. People here believe the inaction emboldens Saudi Arabia to continue its crimes in Yemen. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Palestinian factions in the blockaded Gaza Strip protested in front of the UNRWA office against aid cuts and demanded the agency scrap the so-called framework agreement with the United States. The framework agreement signed last July is a 2-year working plan between the U.S. State Department and UNRWA. The protest comes less than a week ahead of the International Conference on UNRWA that will be held in Brussels under the chairmanship of Jordan and Sweden. The Hamas movement said the agreement exposes Palestinian refugees to grave dangers.
We call on donor countries to provide UNRWA with all necessary funding and alleviate the suffering of millions of Palestinian refugees. We also maintain that the framework agreement will place UNRWA under the U.S. hegemony and undermine the Palestinian refugees' right of return to the land of their ancestors.
The UN agency provides education, health, and welfare services to millions of Palestinian refugees in Al-Quds, the occupied West Bank, the Gaza Strip, Lebanon, Syria, and Jordan. During a press conference, Palestinian factions slammed the silence of the international community over the plight of Palestinian refugees.
Settler colonialist regimes that helped Zionist gangs occupy Palestine and displace its people in 1948 must stop helping the Israeli regime. Upon the creation of the illegitimate Zionist entity, those gangs destroyed over 500 Palestinian towns and villages and committed dozens of massacres against the indigenous Palestinian population.
UNRWA has long been a priority target for the Israeli regime and its allies. Over the past decades, the Israeli regime had been campaigning to defund UNRWA and end its mandate.
The so-called framework agreements between the United States and UNRWA aims to cancel the rights of Palestinian refugees. Palestinians across the political spectrum denounced the agreement. The U.S. wants to turn the UNRWA into a security agency in the occupied territories.
Experts say the so-called framework agreement with UNRWA is an attempt by the United States to delegitimize and depoliticize the issue of Palestinian refugees. UNRWA is a UN agency responsible for the welfare of millions of Palestinian refugees in West Asia who were displaced and dispossessed upon the creation of the Israeli regime. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Since February, there has been calm at the line of control, a de facto border that divides Kashmir between India and Pakistan. But despite relative peace at the border, the situation in the Indian-administered Kashmir is precarious. There have been daily reports of human rights abuses.
The people of the occupied territory continue to suffer under India's brutal military siege. Extrajudicial killings, arbitrary arrests, and detention of Kashmiri youth, harassment, and custodial torture continue with impunity while fundamental freedoms are suspended and Hurriyat leadership remains incarcerated.
Against this backdrop, a special envoy of the 57-member Organization of Islamic Cooperation, or OIC, is visiting Pakistan. His visit is aimed at getting the first-hand account of the ground situation of the disputed territory. The special envoy met Prime Minister Imran Khan, who briefed him about the current situation in the Indian-administered Kashmir. But the public opinion is divided over the role of OIC on Kashmir.
I feel OIC has played no significant role in the resolution of the Kashmir dispute. The OIC has not pursued the issue at the international level.
Major problem in Pakistan.
Kashmir is a major problem between the two countries. Except for passing a few resolutions, the OIC has not done enough for the Kashmir cause. It should play a more proactive role.
In an official statement, the OIC special envoy expressed Islamic world's abiding solidarity and support to the legitimate Kashmiri struggle for their right to self-determination as enshrined in the relevant UN Security Council resolutions. Kashmir is at the heart of tensions between India and Pakistan for over 7 decades. Both countries claim the region in full, but rule only parts of it. While Pakistan has granted access to the OIC special envoy to its part of Kashmir, India has barred international delegations from visiting its part of Kashmir. This, Pakistan says, highlights Indian effort to hide human rights abuses in the disputed region. Kamran Yusuf, Islamabad.
Islamic Jihad movement held a massive festival in the Gaza Strip marking the second anniversary of the assassination of Baha Abu'l-Ata, Islamic Jihad commander, who was killed by Israeli airstrikes on his house. Targeting Abu'l-Ata triggered a tough round of violence between Palestinians and the Israeli regime.
We are here to express our support to the resistance front that has never failed to defend us. Palestinians in Gaza are living in a continuous struggle, but this makes us more determined to defend our rights.
Baha Abu'l-Ata was the head of Al-Quds Brigades, the armed wing of Islamic Jihad. Baha was one of the most prominent members of its military wing and played a major role in carrying out operations against Israel.
We will remain steadfast and committed to our oath to our leader, Baha Abu'l-Ata. Losing our commanders won't undermine our resistance. We will resist and won't be hesitant to defend our people and the Palestinian cause.
Palestinians in this event also stressed following in the footsteps of Abu al-Ata in the battle against the Israeli occupation, vowing to keep their resistance until their rights are restored.
Our message to the Israeli regime is that if you assassinate a leader, there will be thousands of other leaders to continue the path of resistance. The killing of Palestinian leaders won't undermine our will to keep up our fight against Israel.
Palestinians here say that the killing of the leaders won't stop the battle against the Zionists. They also vow to remain committed to their resistance as their only means to defend their rights. Ruba Shavit, Gaza.
New Delhi hosted a third regional summit to discuss the ongoing situation in neighboring Afghanistan following the recent pullout of U.S. and NATO forces from the country. The conference was chaired by India's National Security Advisor Ajit Doval and his counterparts from other Central Asian nations. India's National Security Advisor opened the dialogue.
We all have been keenly watching the developments in that country. These have important implications not only for the people of Afghanistan but also for its neighbors and the region. This is the time for close consultations amongst us, greater cooperation and interaction and coordination among the regional countries.
Top security officials reiterated pledge to work for ensuring safe Afghanistan and what they called free of safe haven for global terrorism. The delegates also called for formation of inclusive government in Kabul, stressing the territory should not be used for sheltering, training, planning or financing terror activities.
This could perhaps be the first time Central Asian countries are coming together on a single platform to not only discuss their role in rebuilding war-ravaged Afghanistan, but also formulate a collective strategies which could promote peace, stability and security in the region.
Issues related to radicalization, extremism, separatism and drug trafficking in the region were also discussed in the meeting. The officials expressed deep concern about the sufferings Afghan people have endured before and after the U.S. fallout. Secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council, Ali Shamkhani, stressed on rebuilding inclusive Afghanistan, saying U.S. policies brought nothing but miseries and devastation in the region.
Afghanistan's neighbors need to fulfill its duties to settle the crisis unfolding in the country, including efforts to hold to account the countries behind the current situation there, establish an inclusive government comprised of all ethnicities there, and tackle the humanitarian crisis gripping the war-torn country. The Islamic Republic of Iran is ready to rebuild Afghanistan. Regional partners should also exert pressure on the United States to unblock the financial resources of the oppressed nation.
Security chiefs from Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Russia, Tajikistan, Turkmenistan, and Uzbekistan also attended the talks. However, neighboring China and Pakistan did not attend the forum, citing scheduling reasons. The first two editions of the event were held in Iran in September 2018 and December 2019. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
Leaving amid shouts of shame, Israel's UK ambassador, Zippy Hotovly, escorted flower in hand by her security detail to her car as British police ward off peaceful pro-Palestine protesters earlier this week. Hotovly, a fervent opponent of Palestinian statehood, had been controversially invited by the London School of Economics Student Union to a debate on Middle East peace.
As she emerged from the debate, she was met with students and pro-Palestine activists exercising their democratic right to protest. But there was a problem with that. It was a peaceful protest against the ambassador of one of Britain's closest allies with powerful pressure groups in British politics.
That has meant a torrent of criticism and condemnation from the pro-Israel media and government ministers. From the British Foreign Secretary, who has called the protest unacceptable, to the Home Secretary, who has described it as disgusting and anti-Semitic.
Where is the evidence for this? People were opposing the Israeli policy at one, and secondly, this particular ambassador who actually says there is no such a thing as Palestinians. Every inch of the land belongs to the Israelis. So by that definition means that This is encouragement to ethnic cleansing.
Once again, an expression of solidarity for Palestinians portrayed as anti-Semitism. One of the targets of that labeling, the chair of the Islamic Human Rights Commission himself, who spent a lifetime calling out the Israeli regime's repressive apartheid against Palestinians.
What do? They actually try to be sort of racist towards others, use the only tool that they could possibly use of saying anti-Semitic,